The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Last program of the week. Have just a touch of congestion, so my voice might sound a little bit different, but I feel good. I'm excited to carry on with the program and all the content that we've pulled together today. Well, speaking of today, actually tomorrow, 17 years ago tomorrow, that would be February 17th, 2001, my father announced that we'd be opening a college in the fall of 2001. At that time, of course, it was Imperial College. It was a few years later, I think 2006, when we changed the name to Armstrong College. But here we are today, 17 years into it. We're in the midst of our 17th college year. And the fruits of the college, I guess you could look at it in the broad perspective back in 2004, 2005, and maybe not see a whole lot of it. The fruits, that's what I mean there. But you look at it today, and you look at the colleges as it's expanded to Edstone, to all of the digs in Jerusalem. My father, I think it was last summer, he just emphasized to some of us the importance of anniversaries, just so that we don't forget our history. 17 years of Armstrong College. Andrew Locher was telling me a few months back that the church employs something like 225 people worldwide, most of them there at our headquarters campus in Edmond, but quite a few here at Edstone, our Canadian office, our Australian office, the Philippines. We've got employees scattered all over the world, and quite a large percentage of them are in their 20s and 30s. Well, quite a few of them even in their teen years. Because as I think many of you know, when young people come out to the college, they're immediately put into the work-study program where they start working as freshmen. So many of our freshmen are 18 years of age. And so employed by the church at 18, 19, 20 years of age. And then you look at so many of the crucial projects, like the Jerusalem dig, and how that projects like that, I mean, they're staffed pretty much by young people. The growth of the college, Mr. Armstrong in the autobiography, Herbert Armstrong, he talked about how that the growth of the gospel work, how that it directly paralleled the growth of Ambassador College. He said this over and again in his autobiography. It was the development of the college in Pasadena that made possible the growth of the whole gospel work. That doesn't mean it revolves around the college, God's work. It's just the opposite, as we tell our students all the time. You're here to support the work. The college is here to help the work grow. Mr. Armstrong talked about the crossroads that the work had reached there in the mid-1940s. Again, this is some important history. Anniversaries, we've got to remember them. He said this was to be the real test. Ahead now was the possible transition from a small, struggling, virtually one-man work to a major-scale organization exerting a powerful influence on humanity, the world around. Ambassador College was to provide the only possible means. It was to be the recruiting and training center, integrating into effective organization those whom God would call to surround me, to become this Christ-led and Spirit-powered organism. Ambassador College was to provide the only possible means. God would bring young people into the college to surround his servant, his apostle, Herbert Armstrong, to help support the work, to help to get the work done. Later on in the book, he said that without the college, the work never could have expanded much beyond its status in the 40s. And look at where that work was in the 1960s and 70s and 80s. And the same can be said today. 2001. What a wonderful history to look back upon. Of course, we purchased the original 40 acres, or I think 38 acres, in the year 2000. I know my father had it on his mind as far as the potential for starting a college, but then the official announcement made then finally February the 17th, 2001, and the plans, we carried on in earnest from that point forward to open the doors in August of 2001 for eight students living on two mobile homes on a big field, basically. In those first few weeks until the John Amos Fieldhouse was completed, they were shuttled into the Waterwood Complex there in the heart of Edmond. And that's where they took all of their classes. And then back out to the trailer at the end of the day. Well, then finally, John Amos Fieldhouse, we opened its doors and started to use that as the multi-purpose center that it was and is to this day. Although we don't have classes out there, but it's the dining hall. It's obviously the gymnasium for all of the PE classes and the intramural sports and such. But that was the hub of the college back in 2001. That's where we did everything. Classes, eating, PE, extracurricular activities, spokesman club. It's grown quite a lot since then. You can see it from all of the structures on campus now. There at headquarters. And here we are today, a small number of us here at Edstone, an extension of that same college, halfway around the world. Mr. Armstrong said, "This is the work of God, and the work of God required a college. God's work requires a college. It's important for the growth of the gospel work." Again, there's a direct parallel. As we see the college grow, we see the work grow. All through the autobiography, you see Mr. Armstrong drawing attention to the fact that the work could not have grown into a powerful worldwide operation without Ambassador College. That's pretty exciting for those of you supporting the work and for those of you who attend the college. Look at Matthew 9. I read this often in lectures and forums at the college. Just to highlight again the importance of everyone's individual role. This would include everyone, not just students at the college. We're all students in God's college. We're all attending a teacher's college because God is training you. If you're listening to this program, you're receiving an education. And God wants you to take that further. He wants you to advance in that education so that you can eventually be used to teach. Matthew 9 and verse 36, it says, "But when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them, because they fainted, and they were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. And then said he unto his disciples, The harvest truly is plenteous, but the laborers are few." We need more laborers, in other words. We need more contributors. We need more young people. We need more employees. We need more field members. We need more co-workers and donors. There's always been a need for young people to support God's work. Look into the Old Testament and the schools of Elijah and Elisha and how many, the schools of the prophets. The young people that came along in support of those works. The works of those prophets of God. Here in verse 38, Matthew 9:38 says, "Pray you therefore the Eternal of the harvest, that he will send forth laborers into his harvest." See, pray for additional laborers. How much are you doing that? How fervently are we praying for God to add more to our numbers so that we can grow the work, so that we can reach more people? Today, we not only have two college campuses, we have an Imperial Academy. I mean, it's been around, 10 or 11 years? My children have grown up in Imperial. I think Jude was in kindergarten down the road there in Edmond, but started his first grade year at Imperial, the inaugural year of Imperial Academy. Now he's in 10th grade. My daughter's about to graduate from the high school, hopefully go on to the college. And look at all the opportunities that God's given to our young people. And look at what this college program, look at what the educational program in God's church has done for the work. It's pretty amazing, the emphasis that God puts upon our youths, our children, our young people. And it's an important emphasis. Because look at the young people of the world today. Just drifting without any hope, without any sense of direction or understanding of what's important. This emphasis has been put upon the young people from the earliest days of God's work under the direction of Herbert Armstrong. Listen to what he said back in 1979 about this special interest that God has in the youth, clip 6.
So God has a very special interest in teenagers. And I'm afraid we haven't been cognizant enough of that fact in the past. I know that when my daughters were young and I was first converted, my whole mind was on the Bible and the things I was finding there. And somehow, I don't think I had enough time for my children, because I had two daughters at the time. And then two sons came along 10 years after the two daughters and after my conversion. But even so, my time was so filled up with the Bible and getting the work of God going and things like that, that I didn't have the time that I should have taken. I had the time. That really makes me think about when I was in high school, back about where some of you have been. And I think this was in about third year high school. And I didn't have a lesson. And the teacher asked me why, and I said, well, I didn't have time. And she said, Herbert Armstrong, how many hours are there in a day? Well, I said, 24 hours in a day. Well, how many of those hours do you have? You know, I was sort of chagrined and floored and embarrassed. I have all 24 of them. She says, you just didn't spend those hours in the right way. That's all was wrong with you. Well, sometimes that is the case. But after my original Bible study that resulted in my conversion, I was so overwhelmingly interested in the Bible and the new knowledge that God was opening to me that, well, I thought I was giving time to my two sons as they came along, and also to the daughters who were 10 years older than they were. But I know that I wasn't giving them anywhere near the time that I should. I was thinking about adults and about the things, and you can't do everything all at once.
That's Herbert Armstrong from a message you gave back in 1979, speaking openly there, even about some of the things that he learned along the way. And, of course, carrying on from that sermon, I mean, really, The golden age of the Worldwide Church of God was from the point of that message you heard there until the time of his death in 1986. And like I bring out in Raising the Ruins, so much of the emphasis was put right upon the young people, the church, God's family, turning the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. Just as it says there at the end of the book of Malachi. That's where the focus was. I mean, that's how the work is sustained. That's how you grow the work. This is the, as we've also quoted from before, I don't have the quotes here in front of me, but Mr. Armstrong said, this is the most important group we can reach. Our own children. You think about the foundation that they have growing up in the church, receiving all of this instruction, learning the scriptures, reading from the Royal Vision or the True Education magazine, studying Mr. Armstrong's material, learning from history. And of course, being spared from so many of the scars and the perversions of the world today. They're not perfect, but what an education. What an opportunity. If young people will grow up in these ways and really embrace it, train them up in the way that they should go, and when they're older, they'll stay with it. They won't depart away from it, the proverb says. That's the importance of education. Moses told the Israelites in the wilderness, look, you teach these things to your children and you be diligent about it. Remind them of it when they're walking by the way, when they get up during the morning, when they go to bed at night. Teach them. Teach them their own history. Teach them from the Bible. Mr. Armstrong, in that sermon that you just heard there, he went on to say, I'm very thankful that the time has come that God's church is going to take a new interest in parent and children relationships and in the relationship of children of our parents in the church. He was very thankful, even as he was about to reach 89, 90 years of age. He was very thankful that the time had come in God's church to bring parents and children together. So important. Teach that teacher-student relationship, that parent-child relationship. There's real strength in God's church, in God's work. There's real strength in the church if there's real strength in the families. It's the same with nations. We see our nations disintegrating, falling apart, in decline, because our families have broken down. It's like I said on yesterday's program, and no one wants to address this. Here are all these laws in place, laws that are being broken, for example, in the case of the most recent mass shooting, and all that man can come forward is with, well, hey, we need to have new laws. We need to have more laws. We need to have some gun control laws. Well, there are gun control laws on the books. You do have to register. You do have to go through a background check. You have to go through all these things. The problem is not that we need more laws. The problem is that we're a lawless society. The problem is that we're not obeying the laws that are already there. Let's talk about root causes then. Why? Why are so many young people resorting to violence and hatred? Why is our society so lawless? Why is it upside down? Where are the parents? Or in the case of this most recent mass murderer, where was the father? Good question. It's an uncomfortable question for some. Where was the teaching? Where was the instruction? Where were the law enforcement officials when all of the red flags were going up? Where were the authorities when the school kicked him out and said he's dangerous? No, all that most people can do is say, hey, what about if we pass more laws? Okay, more laws that more people can break? That more people can disobey? That more people can rebel against? Here we are, we just want more and more laws. And the problem with our society is we don't obey laws. That's the problem. How do you solve that problem? It's a shame more people don't wake up and look at the laws of God. God keeps it very simple for us. 10 points, 10 commandments. Even more simple than that, Jesus said 2 great commandments. To love God with your whole heart and soul, and to love your neighbor. To love your neighbor as yourself. Are these mass murderers learning how to love their neighbors as themselves? Are they being taught that? You know, these same people that say we need more laws, gun control laws, you bring up the Bible with them, they say, well, no, we don't want the Bible. We don't want the Bible involved in our lives. We don't want any strict teaching about morality. We don't want religion, period. We don't want religion to factor into anything we're doing. how do you reconcile these two notions? On the one hand, you want law. On the other hand, you want to get rid of law. If people really are excited about implementing laws, why don't we talk about God's law? Why don't we talk about the Word of God? Why don't we talk about fathers teaching their children like Moses said to the Israelites in Deuteronomy 6? You shall teach them diligently unto your children, and you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up, and you shall bind them for a sign upon your hand. And they shall be as frontlets between your eyes, and you shall write them upon the posts of the house and on your gates. And it shall be, when the Eternal your God shall have brought you into the land, which he sware unto your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob, to give you the great and goodly cities, which you build not, and the houses, well, and on it goes. This is how you'll be strong, God said to the Israelites. If you obey these commandments, you're going to be strong and you're going to live long. You're going to be strong and you're going to go in and possess the land. You'll prolong your days. You'll be blessed. All of the wonderful blessings and benefits of obeying God's laws. We see our society around us breaking down, falling apart. It's a dangerous and evil society that we're in. And amazingly, you have more and more people coming forward and saying, you know what we need? We need more laws. No, what we need is to obey the laws that are already there, most especially God's law. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to contact the program, you can send emails to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
I'm speaking to you from our television studios in Pasadena, where I speak to the world as a voice crying out in the wilderness of modern religious confusion.
Herbert W. Armstrong was the world's leading televangelist and one of the most prominent religious leaders of the 20th century. Watched, read, and followed by millions worldwide. But his legacy of Bible-based humanitarianism came under attack after he died. The cabal of leaders who took control of the church he founded, after pledging to follow in his footsteps, methodically destroyed all he had built. Those who would stop them were silenced or excommunicated. This shocking story of betrayal and deception is told in Raising the Ruins. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
Now he said, this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed or preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come.
Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine.
The Trumpet Daily.
Speaking of laws, my father has often talked about the law of history. This is something, by the way, that we want to try to incorporate into this program with a weekly installment or feature. We're still trying to iron that out, but we are accumulating quite a lot of material to go toward that effort. A fair bit of it to hear recently on Shakespeare and the British Empire. My father had an article what was it, back in 2016, a year and a half ago, in our Royal Vision magazine, Shakespeare and the British Empire. And as it happens, he has a program on that very subject this weekend. So we're taking our cue from him and bringing out some of that material that we've been collecting. Most of it, as you'll see here, revolving around the content on this weekend's program. William Shakespeare is surely the greatest non-Bible writer of all time. I mean, those authors, those 40-some authors that put together the Bible, they were writing under the inspiration of Almighty God. But yet you look at William Shakespeare, and so much of his writing was so profound because he was grounded in many ways, he was grounded in the Bible. He really studied his Bible. And so my father draws attention to some of that. And with respect to the British Empire, I mean, it really was instrumental, Shakespeare's writings, in laying the groundwork for the British Empire. Shakespeare came on the scene during the reign of Elizabeth I, while the future of that great British Empire was basically in its infancy stage. It wasn't quite at the point where God would pour down all of those blessings promised to Abraham. But he was laying the groundwork and using William Shakespeare to prepare this nation for its greatness. Here's what my father has to say on that program playing this weekend, soundbite number one.
William Shakespeare helped lay the foundation of the beginning of the great British Empire. And that empire came on the scene in the very early 1800s. The British people had in many ways been prepared to rule that empire, and I think William Shakespeare played a key role in that, getting them ready to rule over the greatest empire ever on this planet. It was huge, and the sun never set on that empire because it was really literally around the whole world.
It encompassed the world, and Mr. Armstrong, of course, writes about this at length in the United States and Britain in Prophecy. But Shakespeare, he talked about empire, he talked about what it took to sustain empire in that original article from June 2016, my father's piece. He wrote, God had big plans, world-ruling plans, for Britain in these latter days. Is it possible that in order to help Britons in that task, God would do all he could to enable them to become educated? I think God would give his birthright nation, who had David's throne, a royal education to give it every opportunity to do great things with the empire. It was, after all, an empire that reached out to the whole world. It is logical to me, he said, that God would want Britons to be able to think and conduct themselves as true leaders, and that he would educate them for that role. It goes back to what I was saying just there in the first segment. They needed education. The children need education from the parent. And so Moses, in the case of the Israelites, he said, now you teach these things to your children, or else you're going to forget your history. You're going to forget all of that glorious history. You better write it down. You better lock it in. Over in Deuteronomy 11, verse 21, it says that your days may be multiplied, and the days of your children, in the land which the Eternal sware unto your fathers to give to them, as the days of heaven upon the earth. You better make sure you remember your history, or else you're going to lose the empire. My father wrote, I believe God had a hand in the life of William Shakespeare for that purpose. He said, imagine sitting down in the early years of, or rather the early days of that empire for entertainment and reading the works of William Shakespeare, a man who thought more deeply than any man in the British Empire. Do you think God might have had a hand in that? That kind of education? That kind of instruction? Look at what we sit down and indulge in today. When we're tired and we want to consume entertainment, even if it's not the horrible stuff that you see so much in the world, but just something lighter. I mean, is it even close to what they would have been sitting down with in Shakespeare's day, or maybe 2, 3, 4 generations following Shakespeare? Winston Churchill, for example, he loved Shakespeare. He loved Macaulay and Shakespeare. He memorized great passages of it. That was part of his education in the late 1800s. And as it happens, that's when the empire was at its peak. Do you think that had anything to do with the way Churchill thought about empire? It sure did. Here's what my father went on to say, or actually this is this weekend. Make sure if you haven't seen it yet that you watch Shakespeare and the British Empire. This is my father's latest show on the website this weekend, thetrumpet.com. Here's clip 2.
Another quote here, James Russell Lowell wrote, "It may be reckoned one of the rarest pieces of good luck that ever fell to the share of the race that was true of Shakespeare. Its most rhythmic genius, its acutest intellect, its profoundest imagination, and its healthiest understanding should have been combined in one man." He says it was just luck. But was it just luck? Or do you think maybe God might have had a hand in that, because he did give this birthright blessing to Britain and all that world-girdling empire? And so he had to certainly get the British peoples ready to do that job. I mean, it takes some ability to rule the greatest empire there ever has been on this earth. Amazing. And he goes on to say, all the favorable stars seems to have been in conjunction at his nativity. Well, favorable stars. I think, again, he thinks maybe there was something to it besides just luck himself, perhaps.
That's my father from this weekend's program. You wish some of these more modern authors that they would just acknowledge the hand of God. Even William Manchester's book, which is outstanding, he certainly talks in certain passages about just how seemingly miraculous it was for Churchill to be spared, like when he was captured in South Africa during the Boer War, and later was about to be killed and was rescued by this mysterious horseman that came out of nowhere. All these other instances, several of them, where God intervened clearly to protect him because of the job that he had for him to do later in life. And yet too many of even the ones that are really somewhat conservative talk about it as if it was just kind of luck that, well, even for the empire, it was just kind of luck. It all came together. I mean, how could it happen? This tiny little island, you know, in the middle of nowhere, really, off the shores of the European continent. How could it gain control of the whole, the better part of the earth during the 1800s? Well, it was this, and then this factor, and this factor, and, you know, everything just kind of came together, luckily. No, it had to do with those promises that God made to Abraham. So God was going to bestow those promises, just as he had said, but then as a way to prepare for receiving of them, he used individuals like William Shakespeare as a tool to educate the whole nation, to prepare them to rule the world. I mentioned Churchill, as I said. And my father touched on that even in his program. I don't think it's in this next clip, but let me just play this for you first, and then I'll make a few more comments on the way Shakespeare and Churchill's education impacted him regarding the empire. First, though, here's clip 3.
Let me read you another quote referring to William Shakespeare. This is taken from The Mysterious William Shakespeare, The Myth and the Reality by Charlton Ogborn. in this part, he quoted Herman Sinsheimer, and this is what that man said. There was not room enough for him in the island of Britain. He had to roam far and wide in order to keep his genius supplied with raw material. Like Drake and Raleigh, he discovered and held as booty the material which set his imagination on fire. Between the lines and between the characters, one may read the legend, quote, "Our island is too small. Our kingdom is the world. Our kingdom is the world." And they almost rule the world. They certainly had control of the real power in the world at that time.
That's from my father's program this weekend, going back to that 2016 piece. He said, Shakespeare's works testify that he believed in the expansion of the British Empire. His writings probably inspired many British leaders to see that little England was too small. They needed to expand. And then my father said later, Winston Churchill, a firm believer in the greatness of the British Empire, also studied Shakespeare at great length. Churchill often lamented about the little Englanders who lacked vision. They didn't see the purpose of the empire and what good it could do. They were selfish and small-minded. He says that same mindset exists in Britain today, but a lot worse. Selfish, you see. Small-minded. Churchill wasn't that way. Let me read to you what Churchill said. This was during his first political address, way back in 1897. Listen to this. It says, There are not wanting those who say that in this jubilee year our empire has reached the height of its glory and power, and that we now should begin to decline as Babylon, Carthage, and Rome declined. Do not believe these croakers, but give the lie to their dismal croaking by showing by our actions that the vigor and vitality of our race is unimpaired, and that our determination is to uphold the empire that we have inherited from our fathers as Englishmen. He says, then shall we continue to pursue that course marked out for us by an all-wise hand. There's God, you see. Marked out for us by an all-wise hand, and carry out our mission of bearing peace, civilization, and good government to the uttermost ends of the earth. That was Winston Churchill in his first political address. Do you know how old he was when he uttered those words? 23 years of age. He was 23 years old when he was saying, don't you believe these croakers who talk about, well, it's inevitable for the empire to decline. Look, we've got to remember our forefathers. We've got to go on determined to uphold the empire that we've inherited from our fathers. Our fathers gave us this. We can't just squander it away. We can't just let it go. Churchill said in another speech later in life, he said, the empire is worth the blood of the noblest of its citizens. Britain spilled a lot of blood all over the world. Not as much probably as it should have. That's another point Manchester brings out in volume one of his series on Churchill. Just all of these incredible victories and how that it didn't cost. I mean, considering that they were all coming from this little island, these British armies. I mean, they had this massive navy, of course, but they didn't just have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of people. And yet, wherever they went in the mid to late 1800s, they expanded the empire, and it was all worth it. As far as Churchill looked at, of course, today, I understand, I know that what's fashionable today is you've got to say that the empire was bad. You've got to criticize the empire. You've got to feel guilty about it. You've got to make apologies. Churchill didn't say that. Churchill didn't think that way. Churchill saw the good that it brought to all of these territories. And in many cases, they were savages in some of those territories. To bring a civil society, to bring laws. Here again, don't we want laws to protect people? Education, discipline. One commentator, by the way, this is, you can read about Churchill and think, wow, he was ahead of his time. I mean, man, he was envisioning the tank and wondering about when a bomb was going to be made that could, you know, harness the energy of the atom and such. And one commentator said that Winston had the 20th century in his blood. Like he was ahead of his time, in other words. Back in the 1800s, I mean, he should have been born in the 1900s. Of course, he lived on into the 1900s. He crossed into both of those centuries. But the point Manchester makes is that it was just the opposite. It was the 19th century that Churchill had in his bones. He was grounded in his nation's history. This was the peak of the British Empire. He was a man of empire. And so he said to his people in the late 1800s, there are those coming along saying we've just got to go along with this inevitable decline like Babylon and Carthage and Rome. Don't you believe these croakers? We've got to uphold the empire that we inherited from our fathers. This is a man who knew his history. This is a man who loved history. This is a man who, for the most part, he was self-taught. He just dug into history. He loved it. He loved it. He wasn't the greatest student at school. He wasn't good taking tests. But he sure loved history. He loved the English language. My father's talked about this before as well. He loved memorizing Macaulay and Churchill. He had a fascination with words. When he went off to boarding school, well, they had to put him in the simple class just to learn English because he wasn't good at Latin and Greek like some of the other smarter ones. It says here, I got into my bones the essential structure of the ordinary British sentence, which is a noble thing. And when in after years my schoolfellows, who had won prizes and distinction for writing such beautiful Latin poetry and pithy Greek epigrams, had to come down again to common English to earn their living or to make their way, I did not feel myself at any disadvantage. He knew the English language, and he was a voracious reader as well. His university, it was his books. Violet Asquith, she said, and this was one of his contemporaries in government, she said one of his strengths was his lack of formal education. His colleagues, steeped in classical erudition and experience, were intellectually jaded. But to Winston Churchill, she wrote, everything under the sun was new, seen and appraised as on the first day of creation. His approach to life was full of ardor and surprise. Even the eternal verities appeared to him to be an exciting personal discovery. He was unashamed, she noted, of speaking simple truths. He was not ashamed of speaking simple truths. He was grounded in history. He said a leader has to learn history. That's the way you get vision. He said the longer you look back, the farther you can look forward. And so he looked back into Macaulay and Shakespeare and others. And he had vision because of it. He lacked the formal education, But as a voracious reader, here he was in the 1920s, just anxiously waiting for Hitler's Mein Kampf to be translated into English so he could devour it and understand Hitler and what motivated him. And then years later, when Hitler's amassing power and he's going around Europe assuring people that, look, I'm not interested in any kind of aggressive war. I'm not going to start a war. Churchill didn't believe him. You know why? Because Churchill had read in Mein Kampf from Hitler himself, the great masses of people will more easily fall victims to a great lie than to a small one. He knew Hitler was lying. Because he just accepted what Hitler said himself. What did Violet Asquith say? Well, he wasn't ashamed of speaking simple truths. It's a pity we don't have more of that today. Simple truths. Well, there's more, as I say, that we want to get into. In the weeks ahead, just with respect to this law of history, making that a regular feature of our program. Hopefully, we can continue on with more of this this weekend. But for now, let me just again refer you to my father's program, Shakespeare and the British Empire. That's the Key of David program, posted at thetrumpet.com this weekend. When we come back, we'll conclude with a few emails that have come in over the past week. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Perhaps no hour in Britain's history was darker than that preceding World War II. Nazi Germany was arming. Nations in Europe were being conquered, their borders redrawn. Britain, the nation that once ruled one quarter of the earth, teetered on the edge of survival. Many leaders in Britain feared war. They wanted to disarm. They spoke of peace as Europe sank deeper into the pit of war. This dark hour may have been Britain's last, were it not for one man. This man stood alone in the face of adversity at home and abroad. He rose to the occasion when his nation needed him most. He vowed that Britain would never surrender when confronted by forces of evil. Winston Churchill took Britain's most important job during Britain's darkest hour. He did what others were afraid to do. Some doubted his methods, but the results speak for themselves. Churchill led Britain from the precipice of ignominious defeat and possible death to what became one of the nation's brightest hours. What was it that made Winston Churchill so different from other leaders of his time? Surely now, more than ever, this world needs another Winston Churchill. Our booklet, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman, explains what made this man such a great leader. We would like to offer this booklet to you free of charge. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
So, Shakespeare really did expand the minds of many of the British people, especially the leaders. And they read Shakespeare and they know about Shakespeare. Winston Churchill, Abraham Lincoln loved William Shakespeare and said, look, all you need is Shakespeare in the Bible, and you can be a really well-educated person. That's how Abraham Lincoln thought about this. And Samuel Johnson called him Britain's triumph or the soul of the age. In other words, there was just a spirit there that William Shakespeare gave to the British people.
That's from my father's program this weekend, Shakespeare and the British Empire. He talks about Shakespeare and the Bible. That's all you need. Those two. Mark Jenkins, our English instructor here at the college and with the academy, he suggests if you're looking to get your young people, your children, interested in Shakespeare, that you might start with Julius Caesar. It's a story flow that's pretty easy to follow. Shakespeare can be a challenge for for young people coming out of today's modern system of education, for sure. But Caesar is an easy enough plot to follow, and it has some great soliloquies in there. We've seen it twice here at Stratford-upon-Avon. We're blessed here, of course, just being 6-8 miles down the road from the Royal Shakespeare Company. And we've seen several Shakespeare plays over the last few years, but that one certainly stands out as one of my favorites. And here recently, a few of us, we've tried to, not always with great success, but we've tried to just do more reading in anticipation of viewing the play on stage, just so that we can get more out of it. None of us are Shakespeare scholars by any sense of the imagination, but to be exposed to that sort of teaching and education, there's so much value to it. So if you're looking for a place to start with getting your children interested, Julius Caesar is one that that I would recommend. A few emails here. Firstly, I didn't bring this this most recent email down with me. It was a short one, just commenting on yesterday's show, saying that it was I think his favorite show of all time. So just a plug for yesterday's program. You can get to all of our programs on the website, thetrumpet.com. This other one here says, thanks to the example and inspirational teaching of the PCG, my daily work schedule doesn't allow hours of mindless television watching. But while passing the time recently, I realized that even just a few clicks of the remote can reveal a whole lot about our nation's spiritual condition. It occurred to me recently while surfing the channels how all that harmful behavior some of us grew up viewing on the TV just a few decades back now seems like child's play compared to the harmful mental filth paraded throughout modern popular culture. To think this is now the reality of some poor youth without adult supervision who has access to this garbage. How sad, to say the least. It definitely makes me want to meditate on the day when once and for all modern Israel will finally promote a new, truly invigorating and lasting eternal culture of peace and happiness. A blessed culture grounded on the absolute obedience to and complete cooperation with the Creator God of heaven and His government. What a wonderful vision. Another one here says, I really appreciated and enjoyed your recent episode about a new disturbing low in American morality, especially when the direction of youth culture trends or cultural trends has moved in the direction of porn acceptance and even into the educational stream. How sick is this? Where's the outcry? Where are the parents to demand an end to this? This reminds me of just the opposite concerning a recent story in a prominent New York school district where a few parents demanded that the father-daughter yearly dance be stopped because it excludes some students who don't have dads or others who live in a household with two moms and no dads. This is what parents are fighting against. They're trying to get the father-daughter dance banned. Shouldn't they be more furious about teaching children pornography? He asks. Where is the sanity? And then he closes by referencing that verse in Isaiah 5 that we mentioned on the program the other day, where we're calling good evil and evil good. That prophecy is certainly being fulfilled. Imagine that. Parents coming forward saying, look, some of us don't have fathers in the household, so to have a father-daughter dance, it's unfair. It's unfair. We've got to do away with it. That's what some are fighting against these days. Another one here in response to, I think this was Joel Hilliker's trumpet brief from about a week ago. Thank you for the article on stealing from the checkout line, the self-checkout line. It says it was an excellent example of how stealing in all of its forms have saturated society, a society ingrained with the mindset of I deserve, it's mine, just take it. Breaking God's law to not steal takes many forms. Stealing encompasses robbery, burglary, embezzlement, larceny, fraud and every type of scam that can be imagined. And there are other forms of stealing. If we went into a full article on it, it would be mind-boggling. Many people born into society at this time don't even know they are stealing. It has become so commonplace. It's part of the culture, and they don't even recognize it as being wrong. However, many people know it's wrong and either justify it in some way or just do not care. We always hurt someone else when we take instead of give, and that is a concept people will have to be taught. Once again, thank you for shining a light on it. We need that. Please keep up writing about these issues. Another one here says, I've often wondered how that type of checkout could be a safe venue. My daughter uses it often and assured me that all goes through safety checks. I guess not. I myself actually saw a young man stuffing his pants with items and made the manager aware of it. Guess carnal minds let evilness set in quickly. More need for God's daily guidance. Well, that's what we try to provide you with on this program. Daily guidance. This is, after all, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and you're listening to Stephen Fleury. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us this week, and we'll see you next week.